So a few weeks ago, I went to Chinatown, the Chinatown of Jakarta, and it's kind of crazy because apparently they have this like entrance that's very typical of like Chinatown entrance in the Chinatowns around the world, and I've never seen it. I was so shocked that there was like that little corner of Jakarta that I've never known about. It turns out they built this building called Gedung Chandra, and it's like a legit big ass concrete building, and they made it like super China, like they Chinified it. Like the architecture is extremely stereotypical Chinese architecture, if that makes sense. I don't think the real Chinatown was actually like that, because when we do talk to Tao, and he did say like in Southeast Asia it's always been extremely multicultural, but this one is like they had like red lanterns and everything, and they had like all of these like what do you call it? Like red banners and stuff. So it was very like, I think they definitely catered to tourists who have this like romanticized fantasy of what Chinatown is supposed to look like. Anyway, I guess they did a good job because I was pulled in because I was like, oh wow, like I really want to discover this cute shop. I did go into one of those artificial cafes, or not cafe, it was a tea shop, because it looked cute and they did a good job of making it look like one of those
Stereotypical.
heritage Chinatown, Jakarta Chinatown. Also, like on the way, walking from like the main area to that tea shop, there was like a big group of European tourists, and I could hear them speaking with like French and German accents, and American accents too. And I was like, what? Like, this is weird, because I don't know. I just felt like it was weird that I was seeing this big group of tourists in this part of town.
Maybe we have to get used to it.
I think there were like two or three big, tall tourist buses.
Well, I mean, I barely go out. But in terms of living in Bogor, the local I get pissed by the local tourists, you know, the Jakartan people that come into Bogor and just make Bogor trafficked even worse.
Like me. But definitely like that building, you know, it just feels very artificial. Even like the restaurants and cafes inside are not even Chinese food. It's just like regular chain, you know, like restaurant chains
Oh,
that have,
really?
yeah, like they have
It's
branches in there.
Like a food court.
Yeah.
But
Basically, it's like a food court.
Oh yeah, this episode I learned that sriracha is not from Thailand.
Well, technically, it's US American.
Don't know, for some reason what made me think that it's from Thailand, huh? I never Google it. I
Never
never
Google.
ask people where is it from. I think I just came up with it myself. I know. So, should we introduce Tao?
Let's do that.
Napong Rongkapan, who goes by his Thai nickname Tao, is an assistant professor of urban and regional planning at the Faculty of Architecture at Chulalongkorn University in Bangkok. A geographer of urban planning, Tao is interested in the geographic implications of planning intervention. In particular, the technopolitics of urban design and planning, which he defines as the political contestations over knowledge-laden spatial instruments, maps, zoning, building codes, architectural guidelines. The intention is to expose their ideological, political underpinnings that legitimize planning intervention.
His research interests include comparative urban theory, cross-context recollection of planning ideas, gentrification and inner city revitalization, urban architectural heritage, the politics of gentrification, land control, and the impact on socio-spatial justice. He focuses on the politics of urban transformation of Old Town Bangkok, whereby planning instruments are mobilized towards the twofold goal of heritage preservation and tourism promotion. His second line of research explores the architecture of diasporic Chinese heritage in Bangkok, Ho Chi Minh City, Penang, and Singapore.
Tao received his bachelor's degree in international relations and history of art and architecture from Brown University. His senior paper, Harnessing Water, which explored the intricacy of urban water management in Singapore, won the 2008 George Downing Prize in Art History. He then completed a master's degree in planning at the University College London, where he specialized in urban design with study projects in Victoria Embankment, Euston Station, Tower Hamlets, and the Thames Gateway. His PhD research areas include urban form and morphology, the history of the built environment, and cities in Southeast Asia.
Tao is also a member of CNET, Southeast Asia Neighborhoods Network, that supports the development of contextualized knowledge about urban life in Southeast Asia by unearthing new, multidisciplinary knowledge about cities in Southeast Asia and reassessing them through methodological lens of what happens at the micro-urban neighborhood level.
I am currently an assistant professor of urban planning at the Department of Urban and Regional Planning at the Faculty of Architecture at Chulalongkorn University here in Bangkok, Thailand. And before this, I teach at Thammasat University, which is also in Bangkok, for a while in the School of Global Studies. And currently I teach in the areas of urban theory, urban livelihoods, and urban strategies. Although my academic research fields of interest include gentrification, you know, urban theory, and architectural heritage in Southeast Asia. And for my PhD dissertation, which I did at the University of Michigan years and years back, I focused on Chinatowns, you know, in Southeast Asia. And again, Chinatown in quotation mark, because I understand that is a quite, you know, a loaded, a fraught term. But it is a placeholder for, you know, what I call traditionally historical Chinese settlements, you know, in Southeast Asia. And I focused on three cases, you know, the Chinatown in Bangkok, in Penang, Malaysia, and Ho Chi Minh City, in Vietnam. So I've always been interested in the historical urban centers of Southeast Asia, so old towns, you know, in Bangkok, in Penang, and also in Singapore and in Vietnam as well.
What made you want to focus on the Chinatowns of Southeast Asia?
Good question. I think it is somewhat a little bit of a coincidence. I knew from the start that I wanted to do a comparative research, you know, comparative urban research. And at the time that I was doing my PhD, the field of urban theory and urban studies, you know, was excited by, you know, what we call the comparative imagination, how to expand, you know, the conventional, you know, urban theory, which tends to, you know, focus on a few cities in the global north, you know, global cities, big cities, you know, New York, London, Paris, and Tokyo, and things like that. And I was inspired by the urban scholar Jennifer Robinson, who wrote a book called Between Modernity and Development, Ordinary Cities. So she wanted urban scholars to focus on ordinary cities, right? To look away and to find comparable experiences. And I knew from the start that I was interested, you know, in Southeast Asia, Southeast Asian cities, and also I want to do something comparatively, you know, to see how the same phenomenon, you know, pans out differently in different cases. So I came upon, you know, Chinatown, using it as an entry point to look at, you know, the phenomenon of, you know, urban development and redevelopment in the context of old towns in Southeast Asia, looking at how Chinatowns, you know, they have to kind of reinvent themselves, you know, from the, I don't know, ethnic enclaves, you know, into becoming more touristy, more festival oriented, more tourist oriented spaces that we have today.
Oh, yeah. Interesting. Is there any like design similarities between those countries in terms of the Chinatown?
Good question. The building typologies are similar. They tend to be, you know, shop houses, you know, narrow townhouses built side by side, because that is the nature, the economic nature of Chinatown in the early 20th century. You want to maximize, you know, space. Mm-hmm. So therefore, you have to condense the architecture. You have to pack in so many functions. So that is why it is called, you know, a shop house, mm-hmm. because, you know, they live on the upper floor, you know, the house, and then the on the ground floor, you have the shop. So that is the flexible, you know, the versatile nature of shop houses in Southeast Asia. What's interesting about one other similarity is that, contrary to the name, Chinatowns in Southeast Asia have always been multicultural, very, very cosmopolitan. So in a way, that is why I myself am guilty of the term or the label Chinatown itself, because in a way it is a Western kind of imposition that has been popularized by scholars of the Global North. But then I, again, in my dissertation, I have like this one section where I kind of clarify myself, you know, giving the disclaimer, because port cities, you know, historic cities across Southeast Asia, you know, from Ho Chi Minh City, Bangkok, Yangon, Burma, Penang, Medan, Aceh, Singapore, even Surabaya, for example, have always been multicultural, because of the trade routes, you know, since, I don't know, the 17th century. But somehow the Chinese, you know, have been more, because they were the middle people, the middle men, you know, between the colonial administrators and the local populations. So they had that kind of prominence. But that doesn't mean that the Chinese, you know, were the only ethnicity in what we call Chinatowns in Southeast Asia. Yeah, I'm actually, I've been working on my manuscript, a journal article on the politics of, you know, Chinese cultural heritage in Ho Chi Minh City in Vietnam. And it's an interesting, again, going back to your point about similarity, on the appearance, you know, the architectural appearance or the physical appearance, you know, we have the shop houses, you know, which kind of exemplify, right, the building typology of Southeast Asia. Mm-hmm. But if you look more closely, we see, you know, dramatically different political dynamics, for example, which tend to be more local, more national. In the case of Ho Chi Minh City, for example, you see the context of post-war ideology, where the Vietnamese government tries to project, you know, the Vietnamese identity onto Chinatown, for example. So if you look at the heritage inventory of the Ho Chi Minh City Chinatown, you'll see that the heritage sites, you know, tend to be socialist, you know, the sites that commemorate, you know, socialist histories as opposed to Chinese histories. So yeah, so my argument is that despite the fact that, oh, we have so many Chinatowns everywhere, right? But then I would argue that the national ideology are still important, you know, in sanctioning what is to be recognized as heritage and what is not.
That's interesting. And you don't feel like you see the same kind of nationalist ideology in other places, in other countries?
Oh, it's actually everywhere. And I think it is very common if you look at the pattern of heritage making across, you know, Southeast Asia. And the heritage making movement in Southeast Asia began right after, you know, the decolonization period. So, you know, from the 40s to the 50s all the way to the 60s and 70s. And forging a strong national identity has always been on the agenda of the post-independence, you know, government. You know, how do we create symbols or symbolisms to speak for the national identity? And I think in the case of Jakarta is a very distinct example. If you look at what Sukarno did in terms of the architecture, you know, they want to break away from like the Dutch, but at the same time, they want to project a modern Indonesian kind of monumentality as well. If you look at the large structure, you know, the I cannot remember the name because I'm not an Indonesianist, but there is this so many you know, an array of monuments in Jakarta, the roundabout, I'm not so sure if you know that,
with the statues of the welcoming statues.
That is symbolic, you know, of Jakarta as being the center of modern Indonesia, because all roads, you know, converge around that. But at the same time, it projects, you know, the idea of the new leader of a new nation that is, you know, not Asian in the sense that not, you know, backward, but at the same time, not European either. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so architecture and the built environment, urban planning have always been implicit in the national building agenda after the period of decolonization. So yes, to answer your question, yeah, architecture has always been, you know, caught up in the entangles of, you know, how to project the national identity of a new nation across the region.
Do you think that's still the case with many countries in Southeast Asia to show their identity?
Oh, yes. Oh, and I would even say that it has become more obsessive, even because, really? You know, with the rise of right-wing, you know, politics and right-wing politician across the globe, and you see that kind of the return to the good old days, right? The romanticization of the national past. You see that in Yangon, not the Yangon, in Myanmar. You know, the creation of the new capital, for example, and where they created this historical park with like the you know, larger than life, you know, sizes of statues, you know, that commemorate different kings of, you know, of the past. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. a few years after that, Thailand did the same thing, you know, because Thailand, Myanmar, we consider ourselves kind of arch enemies and things like that. So yeah, there is this, you know, return, you know, to, in a way, historicized identity, which may or may not have existed. And if you look at the, I'm not so sure about Indonesia, but in the case of Thailand, Laos, Cambodia, and Myanmar, for example, mainland Southeast Asia, you know, where throughout history we were taught that we fought one another.
Right.
If you look at the textbooks of these countries, you will see that we pit ourselves against one another. We don't get along. We did not get along. So, and every time, you know, Thai politicians, you know, they want to mobilize a kind of nationalist sentiment, they would invoke that stories, right? That group of stories about, you know, the past enemies as a way to, you know, to stir up, you know, a sense of nationalism.
Right.
So in the early 1990s, in the late 1990s, there was a book, you know, a famous book called Olive, oh my God, I forgot, I keep forgetting names now. I think it is by Thomas Friedman, a journalist of the New York Times. I think the book is called, and you guys might have to check, the Lexus and the Olive Tree, you know, the car Lexus and the Olive Tree. And he said that at that time, you will see a receding of national identity because things are more globalized. You know, people have become more cosmopolitan. The world economy have become more integrated. So therefore, people are becoming more and more of the same. But as you can see from the past, you know, few years, that no, there is a rise of, you know, a sense of nationalism, you know, a sense of religious fundamentalism, ethnic fundamentalism, and things like that. So history is not linear,
right?
I mean, and we are moving towards the path of globalization and cultural homogenization, and we see that people still hark back to the good old days as a way to cement their, I don't know, status quo.
Right. But what about the non-monumental or non-historical infrastructure? Like, for instance, our old airport, I used to call it the bathroom airport because they have like these red tiles. But now we have like a new one.
Yeah.
But from the design of it, I feel like now I use the old one, the bathroom ones, because the new one is like any other airport in the world, you know, there's no characteristic to it. So,
Airports are fascinating, right? Because on the one hand, the government wants to project the idea of modernity, you know, of comfortable first world facilities with, you know, sparkly glass, steel, and you know, all the shiny stuff. But on the other hand, you see the attempt to inject their own national identity as well. You know, the motifs, the design, the color schemes, you know, and again, I think government across the world now, they are trying to balance that. You know, they want to, on the one hand, they want to project themselves as being global, but at the same time, they know that their local identity is still a tourist kind of marketing kind of magnet, you know, so they kind of, you know, they kind of straddle themselves, you know, between the two push and pull dilemmas. On the one hand, of course, you know, there are standards, you know, aviation standards that you have to, for example, for an airport this size, you have to have this many bathrooms, right? We understand that. But at the same time, you will see that sometimes, you know, airports are symbols. And that's one thing that really speaks to me is the airport of Siem Reap, you know, in Cambodia, one of the largest, one of the most beautiful, one of the most modern airports in the world, in the region, in a country that doesn't even have, you know, functioning public libraries or sanitation, right? So that it comes back to the idea of image making, right? Who do you want to please? Who do you want to cater for? International tourists or your local populace?
Earlier, or at the beginning of the episode, you mentioned that
there's a trend of like going back to, you know, this national history and taking pride in like the national independence and things like that. And yet I also observe in Indonesia and Malaysia, kind of, even in Singapore, actually, and like maybe Thailand is the only country that was never colonized, formally colonized. But in Singapore, Malaysia, and Indonesia, people like the tourists, especially local tourists, actually really look up to this European architecture, European feel, and the reconstruction or revitalization of these sites is actually very much focused on like almost like romanticizing that era, I would say. Which I find strange because like lately there's this whole discourse on decolonization and at the same time, people are still like, oh, look at how architecture was, you know, a lot better back when the Dutch, ruled, you know, Java and things like that. So, I wonder if you have observed certain things or, have certain theories about that.
Yeah. I mean, it is interesting in Southeast Asia because I think Southeast Asian countries tend to have a very positive, a favorable view of colonialism, with exception of Vietnam, perhaps, a little bit of Myanmar. But otherwise, you know, in Malaysia and Singapore, you know, they have a positive view of the British, you know, colonization, you know, seeing the positive side. And yes, it is a difficult, you know, conversation to have. And if you look at travel brochures of Air Asia, for example, you know, they use the term colonial in a positive way, right? Oh, go to this place and see the colonial architecture, right? Colonial. And yeah, yes, it is interesting how to make peace, how to come to terms with the our colonial masters. You're right. I as a Thai, I do not have that experience, and I should not be speaking on behalf of other Southeast Asians, you know. But at the same time, how can we accept the built heritage, you know, as a welcomed legacy, but at the same time understand in a very level-headed way, you know, the complex picture of colonialism that do not always produce, you know, positive things, right? But that, at the same time, that doesn't mean that we should negate or cancel, you know, the built heritages that we have received from that era either. So I guess you're right. We have to interrogate our vocabulary more, especially our adjectives, you know, when we use to describe these places. How can we develop a vocabulary that at the same time sees the past as it is without romanticizing it? Right. And when we use the term colonial architecture, of course, we pay respect to the labor of the Chinese labor, Indian labor, you know, that were used to build, you know, that building in what you call a European style. Right. And I think that is the task of architectural history, really, to paint the story, you know, beyond the founder, right, the architect, but also to look at the labor history, you know, who shaped that very building in the first place.
Since you focus on Chinatowns in Southeast Asia, and you've also done comparative studies to Chinatowns in the West that kind of like shaped, you said like shaped the knowledge of urban planning and things like that. In the West, a lot of people have said that Chinatowns are disappearing, that the culture is dying and things like that. Do you feel that's the same in Southeast Asia?
Oh, yes. I think the originality, the original, you know, residence, the original spirit, the original whatever have all gone, I would say. I mean, there are some remnants. I mean, if you go to perhaps, that is why I was very fascinated by the Chinatown of Ho Chi Minh City, because, that's a good case, because it is probably the Chinatown that has not been completely gentrified, to my knowledge, at least. I haven't been back in a long time. Yes, I think because of the land dynamics, you know, the dynamics of real estate, Chinatowns, you know, happen to be located in some of the most, you know, strategic locations in any city, right? So again, if you believe in neoclassical economics, you know, if you are located in a strategic location, it is only natural that your area will transform somehow, some way, sooner or later. Right. But that neoclassical economics. Right. But in sociology, again, we have to ask question again. I guess in neoclassical economics, you know, the conventional view is that change is inevitable. But then sociology would like to ask, like, but again, of course, change is inevitable. But who profits from the change, and then who drives that particular change in that particular time? So, yeah. So Chinatowns in Southeast Asia. In Bangkok, in Ho Chi Minh City, in Penang, you still see remnants, you know, of practices, you know, some people who are some older, you know, generations who are still attached to place and who do not want to move out. So yeah, so I think the landscape is somewhat fragmented. You know, it is not like a wholesale, you know, regeneration or revitalization. You still have pockets of attachment, you know, people who are, you know, unwilling to move out. And fortunately, you know, they are able to because, you know, they own the land. But of course, there are people who are less fortunate.
Well, this conversation leading to your research paper.
Okay.
About the linear tourism.
Right,
so
right.
So the first thing that came into mind when I read the title, what the heck is linear tourism?
Yeah. First of all, it's not a term that I coined myself. It was a term that has been used by a number of tourism studies scholars. So linear tourism refers to a type of tourism that takes you along different stations or different stops along the route that speak to the same theme. Right. So example, the theme could be about exploring foods, you know, multicultural foods, and then you would take to people to different stops in Chinatown, for example, or the linear tour that explore different national heroes, you know, who live in Chinatown, for example. So the idea is that to construct a narrative, but not only in words, but also in sites, right? To take people into different locations as a way to make an argument about the theme of the tour. And so why did I, how did I become interested in the topic? Because I see that as a tactic that has been very popular among, you know, young designers in Bangkok today. Because if you look at the trend or the shifting preferences, you know, of younger tourists or younger customers or consumers, you know, people your age, they tend to stay away from, you know, malls or like, you know, touristy destinations, you know, museums, Disneyland and theme parks and things like that. There is a, once again, the idea of going back to the mundane, you know, more typical, ordinary landscapes, right? And, but again, these sites, you know, the ordinary mundane sites, they are small, right? And they in itself or in themselves, they are not enough to become a tourist attraction. So that's why people have to weave them into the same tour, the same linear tour, and as a way, and in that way, they can project, you know, a kind of a story or a storyline about that particular place. So yeah, so what I was interested in that paper is that how I talked about the role of TCDC, which is Thailand Creative and Design Center, which is a think tank, you know, that was founded a couple of years back, a decade ago, I think, as a way to boost the creative economies in Thailand. And one of the tactics that they use is, you know, linear tourism as a way to promote this creative district in Thailand. And it has been successful in terms of the number of the participants, you know, people coming in, because we have a lot of young, you know, Bangkok residents who did not know anything about their city, but they wanted to come out and learn more about the what their city and their historical neighborhoods have to offer.
Okay.
What is the narrative of urbanization in Bangkok in this way?
Good question. And that is why linear tourism has been popular, because it is flexible, right? You can choose any themes, you know, and again, it depends on the tour organizers, you know, to pick what theme, what narrative that they want to present. And so far, and again, that is my critique, so far, the theme has always been, you know, festive, right? Fun and tourist friendly, like multiculturalism, food, you know, festivals. And what I wanted to critique in that article is that that is not all there is, right? I mean, if you want to take a more critical look at multiculturalism, you should not just look at the peaceful coexistence, you know, of people of different ethnicities in Bangkok, because historical evidence shows that these people do not always, you know, get along, right? And again, there are darker side to the history. So we cannot just, you know, invite outsiders to come in and, you know, and enjoy, okay, the festive environment of this creative district without realizing that the very place was built on, you know, a very contentious, you know, ethnic history.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So from comparing two of your paper, the one about Charongkrang and the food market, Nangleong, is that?
Is there
any dissimilarities between the two of them? Because I saw on the Google map, it's not that far away from each other, right? It's like an hour walk.
They're not far away from one another. They are considered part of Bangkok Old Town. And the key similarity is that they are part of the same phenomenon of the older Bangkok that tries to reinvent itself as a tourist city. So these places, these neighborhoods, they used to be, you know, completely residential or commercial, meaning, you know, day-to-day residential with moms and pops kind of shops, right? But over time, you know, they have become more and more touristified, meaning that as opposed to serving people in the neighborhoods or the locals in neighborhoods, they have to serve tourists as well. And that is the trend. You can call that gentrification, you can call that touristification, but, you know, the fact that the two communities, you know, Nangleong and Jerengrung, they have to reinvent themselves speaks to the broader pattern of urbanization, that the old town has become more and more popular because, you know, if you think about historic centers, you know, in the past, they were not the first location that people think of. You know, they're small, you know, the buildings were dilapidated. We don't have a lot of parking space, you know, we don't have a lot of space for malls and office buildings. So people moved out. But now we see the return, right? Return back to the historic city centers across the world, right? Across Southeast Asia. So yeah, so Nangleong and Jerengrung are but two examples of this trend of coming back, of urban renaissance, if you will.
Mm-hmm. When I research about Charongkrang, it's called the coolest neighborhood in Bangkok now.
I know. It has been named, you know, the Brooklyn of Bangkok, you know, the coolest neighborhood, the hip neighborhood. In a way, it is. In a way, just looking at the architecture, it is so. Have you guys been to Bangkok?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you can tell it gives, you know, a different vibe, right? You know, old town, quirky, on small scale, human scale, intimate, you know, walkable, variety, you know, what not to love about it, right? But at the same time, right, I like to ask the question of whose definition, right? Whose city are we talking about? Whose creative city are we talking about? Like, and who gets to say and who gets to define what does it mean to be creative? What does it mean to be multicultural? And especially when it is, you know, an external imposition, you know, outsiders, designers, you know, coming in and let's beautify the city. And that is good, you know, because the nickname, right, is revitalization, and a harsher cousin would be gentrification. But what's problematic to me is that the locals have not always been consulted as far as the vision of the neighborhood is concerned, because in Bangkok, in Thailand, there is a tendency to trust the experts, people like myself, you know, for example, you know, urban planners, urban designers, you know, academics, people with visions, right on how to design these neighborhoods. But at the same time, we have to understand that these neighborhoods, they are not private museums, right? There are not malls. They have their own dynamics. You know, locals have their own desires, their own anxieties, their own issues as well. And so we cannot simply impose, you know, the beautiful vision of Creative City without understanding whether or not that vision, you know, really responds to what the locals need. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, because I think almost most of the times, the case here in Jakarta at least, when the government wants to build something, for instance, our new like soccer stadium, and I think it's close to your house, Alex.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who like lived there for a long time, they didn't have the certification, so they played that way. I think so. It was like, yeah, so they just displaced them.
I see. Yeah.
There's also a lot of people who it actually happened to some of my family members because they've been in an area in Jakarta for like hundreds of years. And then I think around like maybe the 60s or 70s or maybe 80s, they started wanting to, like, the government wanted to start building like office buildings and skyscrapers and stuff. And they wanted to buy those lands owned by, you know, the regular people, the community, for a cheap price, and then, you know, build corporate offices where that will make the land no longer affordable. Right. And those family members did not have the land certificate, and to apply for land certificate is like so expensive, because by the time they wanted to apply, it had been valued like so high. And so I think like you have to like split the land certificate where you actually technically you live in like a bigger piece of land, but like the certificate only applies for like a quarter of the land that you actually live on. And so the government can sort of like, or whoever, you know, whoever private equity buyer can buy it for a much cheaper price. And I can imagine in places, and that was like in a much more central part of Jakarta. So I feel like in those places where they're building the stadium, which is more on the outskirts of Jakarta, it's probably even more vicious that that kind of dirty play. Yeah,
especially with the metropolitan areas running out of space.
Right. Exactly. I think these stories, you know, are, you know, one of the reasons why I wanted to become like comparativist, because what you have just described, Alexandra, are not isolated incidents, right? That is taking place in Ho Chi Minh City, you know, in Bangkok, and in Manila, the Philippines as well. Yeah. So as comparativists, we like to ask question of why are these, you know, seemingly disparate phenomena are taking place at the same time, right? Mm-hmm. And along the same logic, right? The logic of expelling, you know, the current residents in order to welcome a new type of land use, a new type of social class, a new type of activities all together. Yeah.
Actually, it reminded me, because just before this, you were talking about like royalist tendencies or agendas. And it reminded me actually about this area in Indonesia. It's like a special region. The special region of Yogyakarta. And so they have a royal monarchy, I guess, makes the rules of the land. And I was talking to a friend from Jakarta who has moved there. She married someone from there and moved there. And it's very interesting. So over there, someone who is ethnically Chinese Indonesian are not allowed to buy and own land.
Interesting.
And it goes back to the history of like, there were like a lot of wars, and one of the wars, like the Chinese community there fled instead of fighting the war. And basically they fled because in the past when they tried to fight the war, they ended up getting killed. But because there was that war where they fled, when they came back, the royal family, the monarchy, was like, oh, you guys betrayed us. So now for the rest of life on earth, your descendants can never own land in this special region of Yogyakarta. And so Like, for instance, my friend who married someone who is from that region, they own land. Mm. But like, if he dies, the land will flip to, they call it like hak guna bangun, which is like lease. So so she's no longer going to own the land. She's just going to like lease the land because her husband died. Mm. And I find that so interesting. It's like, even though you're already married, like it still flips if like the, you know.
Yeah.
And that's also, you know, something that's from the agenda of the monarchy, and you can't like do anything or say anything or criticize it. Yeah. You just have to like follow it.
Yeah, that's why I found modern land ownership to be the most horrible fiction, because it actually it belies all of these landed relationships, right? Because right now, what is considered like to be the most determining factor is whether or not you own the land or not, right? In the modern sense. But in fact, if you look at, you know, the throughout history, there were, you know, longer attachments, you know, or landed practices, landed relationships, you know, that were not codified by modern law. And a lot of times the government, you know, will go around asking if you have a title, if you have a land certificate. If not, you know, you do not belong, or you do not own in the modern sense. When in fact, you know, the practice of living is different from owning. Right. I mean, but right now, you know, the ownership has been prioritized as the determining kind of factor. I forgot her name, but there is an Indonesian professor who studies, you know, royal urbanism in the case of Jakarta. I can send you the references later.
Well, you mentioned like an interesting point earlier, that one of your roles is to question like why this phenomenon is happening in about the same time.
Right.
So why is that?
I mean, the easiest way, or the easiest kind of explanation would be to say global capitalism, or people call it planetary capitalism, planetary urbanization, planetary gentrification, meaning that all of these phenomena are taking place on a planetary scale, not at a national scale anymore. Mm. Because the nature of capital, meaning money or people with money, they move around a lot, right? They do not need to restrict themselves within the national border. So we see lots of transnational investors or transnational movements, you know, companies, you know, corporates, people, and they move around, right? And ideas kind of move around as well. So you see that people tend to borrow, you know, from one another in terms of, you know, the image of urban development. So it spreads, all of these, you know, things, you know, ideas, you know, capital, people, they spread on the global planetary scale. And that would be the easiest and at the same time, the laziest, you know, explanation as well.
Okay, yeah. So what does that identity means then? National identity means, if like from each country to
other. Good point. Again, identity, or at least, you know, the desire to retain identity will not go away for sure, as we can see from the case of, you know, Thailand or even in Indonesia as well. I guess for the people who feel like they are mistreated, or they feel like who do not see the even distribution of benefits, they will return to their identity and use that as their currency, right? As a way to negotiate a claim, you know, in the sense of belonging. And we cannot always, you know, blame them, you know, because again, we have, what we can do is to understand, you know, why we have come as a society, why have we arrived at this moment where, you know, the benefits are not evenly distributed. So the more planetary or the more global or the more unfair the distribution is, you know, the more that people will return to their identity as a source of contention.
Right. Mm. When you did this research, you must have talked to so many people like who don't even study these things, right? So when they use the word gentrification, what the first thing that because I feel like even me, I use the term like loosely sometimes. It's not always like displacement, you know.
No, that's a good point. And no, gentrification is increasingly problematic to define, because what we experience now, the gentrification that we experience now, are very different from the gentrification that happened, you know, a century ago. The term, you know, came into popularity, you know, in the 1960s, I guess, in 1950s, 60s. And the case it was used to describe was London. So London in 1960s is very different from the city today, because the actors were different. The actors were limited. You know, the size, the scale, the magnitude of gentrification was a lot more limited. But now gentrification has become very convoluted, very, very complicated, because there are people who benefit from it. There are people, you know, who get displaced from it. So it is very a very difficult conversation to have, because people, you know, come into the table, you know, with different agendas to begin with. So you're right. In the case of Bangkok, and again, I think in most Asian societies, it is very difficult to talk about gentrification, because the idea of growth is always considered a positive thing, right? Yeah. Economic growth is always considered a positive thing. And once you say that you don't like development, you are seen as anti-growth or anti-development, yeah, right? And that itself is very, very difficult to talk about. So I'm glad you mentioned displacement, because what I try to do in my own work is to, you know, to spotlight the areas of gentrification that people do not talk a lot about, which is displacement, psychological displacement, you know, actual displacement. Actual displacement is easy to see, because that is when, you know, people cannot afford and they have to move out. But psychological displacement is when you feel like you don't belong, right? I mean, like, you don't have to be physically displaced, you don't have to be physically kicked out, yeah, but you yourself do not go there, yeah, because you feel like you don't belong. And one of my research projects that I did in a part of Chinatown in Bangkok, it is a small area. It used to be, you know, a traditional Chinatown neighborhood, but now it became like a hipster nighttime bar slash, you know, cafe hangout. That area in the past used to be known for street prostitution and homeless kids as well. So now with the bars coming in, with the cafes coming in, these people, the street prostitutes and the homeless kids, you know, they do not go there anymore. Again, we cannot say that, you know, people force them out, you know, but they force themselves out because they don't feel like they don't belong. They feel like they don't belong. Yeah. And that to me is psychological displacement, which is equally...
even cruel, yeah, I think.
Yeah.
That's very similar to... I'm reminded of a lot of areas in Jakarta that is similar to that.
Yeah, I have a master's student. She's from Jakarta. She's working on gentrification and street vending in Jakarta as well. And when I read, you know, her work, I keep, you know, getting reminded of what's happening elsewhere in Southeast Asia.
You know, actually, since you said street vending, I just got reminded of an interesting story. So I think, like, Ruth, you were the one who told me about this politician. His name is Ridwan Kamil. He's the governor of Bandung. And in Jakarta, people saw him as, like, someone who's really positive and making positive changes. And people were feeling extremely sorry for him because his child died swimming in the river in Switzerland. And a lot of people in Jakarta felt sorry for that. But in Bandung, where he is actually governor, a lot of people really dislike him because apparently he took a lot of taxpayers' money to build this bridge in order for street vendors to, like, sell on that bridge so that they don't sell on the actual streets. And he was trying to, like, clean up the streets and everything. But people said that it was basically useless after he built the bridge. And it's just funny how, you know, you were talking about, like, street vendors and selling on the streets. And in many ways, I also feel at the same time that there are certain places in Jakarta that have been revitalized And they bring in street vendors, but in a modernized way, you know, like not the traditional food carts, but you know, it's very
mostly expensive though, than the, like,
right? Yeah, they make it like hipster and everything, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's like it's funny to see that is the trend where they try to make it like, oh, this is how we used to be, you know, back in the day, but it's very superficial, artificial.
Yeah. I call that the Singaporeanization of urban landscape.
Yeah.
I blame all the urban development ideas on Singapore. That the standards so high, without sharing their secret, which is land tenure context, you know, because the Singaporean government, the Singaporean state owns 70% of the land, so they can literally dictate, right, what goes where. And you know, when government delegates, you know, from Southeast Asia, you know, travel to Singapore under the pretext of learning, you know, they learn about the superficial, right? They learn about what they see, you know, but they did not learn about the mechanisms that enable, you know, these, you know, developments to take place, right? So it's a massive mismatch, really, importing, you know, Singaporean ideals into the rest of Southeast Asia.
Is it because we think that they're quote unquote better, that we adopt all of these things?
And they are in a lot of ways better. They are in a lot of ways more efficient, you know, more sophisticated, more successful. But then again, if you want to learn from a better example, you have to learn their processes as well, right? Not only their products, not only the end products, right? You have to learn about the very difficult paths, you know, in order to get there. And Singapore did not have it easy either, even though they own the majority of the land, but they have some processes, you know, that were in place, you know, before the actual, you know, realization of the grand scheme. Yeah, they didn't, in short, they did not just, you know, do that overnight. Yeah.
It reminds me of, reminded me of, because you were talking about importing. When I spent time in Mexico, there were these areas in Mexico where they imported architecture from California because a lot of the families had moved to California and they sent photographs.
Yeah.
And so they started building their homes with these like balconies in California, but it doesn't fit. And then there are certain areas in Jakarta where they also build balconies, but the house is actually like super dilapidated and fall, you know, like you can see that the paint is peeling off and everything. And it's funny like that they just want to look like the structure of their house is grandiose and westernized.
I know. Yeah.
So in your article on the new Mandela, you mentioned briefly religious gentrification in Malaysia and Indonesia. Could you talk more about that?
Oh, I wrote that short report a while ago, and that I remember that was a reference to my colleague from Malaysia. I don't know much about that, but I can. It is interesting, you know, a green gentrification and religious gentrification. It means that you want to improve the quality of life in a certain area, but based on the ethnicity, the religion, the preferences of a particular demographic group in that area. And if, again, I'm not a scholar of religious gentrification, but I think in that particular incident in Malaysia, it is a case where the middle class, Muslim Malays, you know, they want to create their own kind of precinct, you know, residential precinct, you know, upper kind of upgrade and you know, upscale living environment, but on the basis of their religion, right? I mean, you have to be a Muslim in order to live in this gated community, using the idea of purity as a way to justify, you know, gentrification. And the same, you know, goes for the idea of green gentrification, you know, about how For example, the middle-class neighborhoods, they want to green themselves, you know, by planting more trees, you know, building more parks. But then these parks are exclusionary by nature because they only belong and they are only open to the residents of that particular neighborhood. So what scholars, you know, question in all of these forms of gentrification is that that goes back to the idea of gentrification not being just about economic growth, but gentrification being about exclusion and displacement as well. Yes, you improve, you do physical upgrade, but at the cost of driving out people who you feel do not belong with you.
So in your opinion, what is the most ideal way of city planning or urban planning?
That's a difficult question. To me, again, since I've been, you know, talking bad stuff about Singapore, I think the ideal way should be not in the product, but in the process, right? It should be transparent. Again, personally, I don't care about what you built, you know, I don't care about, you know, what it would look like at the end, but at least if it is accountable, if you can explain it to the taxpayers, you know, if you can make it visible and transparent to the people. And I think that is the first step to ensure that, you know, the benefits, regardless of how, you know, beauty it will be or it will not be, at least, you know, you can go home and sleep at night, right? To say that, okay, at least I can explain myself, you know, at least I can show, you know, the spreadsheets, you know, of and be able to account for all of the details of everything that is going into that plan. Yeah.
So from your paper, the Nanglong Market, some area in Chinatowns are displaced to build like a train station, right? To lessen the traffic in Bangkok.
Right.
And then look up Google Map to just out of curiosity to see how far is Nanglong from Changrongkrang. And I saw that by walking, it would take me like an hour. And by train, then it would also take me an hour.
Yeah.
And by car is like 18 to 20 minutes.
Right.
So
yep.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
Yeah.
Because I thought the vision was like to lessen the time, the like lessen
exactly.
The traffic.
Exactly. I think if you've been to Bangkok, the BTS, which is, you know, the first massive the rail system in Bangkok, that was built, I don't know, two decades ago. Mm-hmm. But according to statistics, you know, the number of car ownerships in Bangkok has increased every year.
Mm.
Yeah. So whatever the claim, you know, whatever the rhetoric, whatever the discourse of using rail as a way to reduce traffic, it has not been proven,
wow.
You know, scientifically. Mm. Yeah.
Wow.
So yeah, no. Short answer is no. But that, like, looking at the big picture, but on like the micro kind of day-to-day level, if you know that, you know, where you want to go to is completely accessible to rail, that would ensure that, you know, rail would be the best
yeah.
option.
I was jealous of Thailand because you guys have like better train systems. But now that we have it, monorail in Jakarta, I was like, man, I can't see the sky anymore. Everything looks gray with concrete.
Yeah.
And like, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that the train system, unfortunately, it only applies to, you know, the metro Bangkok area. And the regional rail is still as bad as when it was built, you know, 100 years ago.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I mean, although there have been plans, you know, to rebuild and reconstruct, but that got, you know, caught into, you know, the regional diplomacy geopolitics with China, because again, we would have had to borrow money from China, and that could be, you know, kind of a dangerous, you know, debt diplomacy. I mean, that what got, you know, Laos into trouble at the moment, because, you know, China has been the major investor in all of the infrastructure projects in Laos. And Laos, unfortunately, does not have enough money to pay back anytime soon.
Yeah.
So,
Yeah, the fast trains in Jakarta are also, or even in Indonesia, in Java Island, are also China-owned.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But what is the consensus of the younger Bangkokians about this all new urbanization and quote unquote beautification?
Yeah, this is a very good question. Because I teach, you know, the generation that I teach now, they are what, Gen Z, you know, Gen Z, right? And they care. The thing is, they care, right? They are so different from, you know, my colleagues, you know, who are a bit older, and they are Gen X. And for them, it is about growth. It is about change. You know, it is about, you know, money making, profit making. But then for the current generation, I mean, the generation that is in college, you know, in university right now, they care and they see things differently. And for them, the price is not the only thing that matters in life, right? They look for differences, you know, they look for uniqueness, they look for some things that you cannot really buy. So with that mindset, with that ideology, so they are naturally inclined towards, you know, preservation, or towards at least respect, right? Mm-hmm. Respect for differences, you know, respect for identity. I have to be that I am inspired, you know, every day by my student, and especially by their willingness to learn, you know, and to see things differently, because, you know, I have given up that kind of hope with my generation, you know, people, we have given up, right? But then again, my students, they still believe in a better world, right? A more just, you know, a more peaceful, a more fair world. Mm. So, and I get inspired every day by them.
Do you feel that there's a detachment between scholars and the people who don't study the theory?
The ivory tower, right? The people who theorize, you know, who want to sit back and observe and theorize about the world, and the actual people who live in the world.
Yeah.
Yes, in every way, you know, by profession, you know, by training, by the nature of their job. And sometimes, you know, I feel that sometimes you know, I'm being harsh, you know, I'm being too critical, because I'm not the one, you know, at the front line, you know, I'm not the one, you know, making a real change. I teach, you know, I write, I study, I theorize. But what I try to do is I try to bridge, you know, that gap.
Mm.
Right. And again, fortunately, I do qualitative research. So it forces me to talk to people, to observe. But at the same time, I have to remain that distance. You know, I have to at least, you know, provide something critical, you know, a gaze that they otherwise would not have. And I do that through writing. I do that through lecturing. So the gap will always be there. And sometimes it is it's not healthy, you know, because, you know, it isolates people. But at the same time, I think it is needed. For you to give an objective view of gentrification, for example, you need that distance to see how problematic it is.
From your website, we've seen that you are quite a photographer, and we saw pictures in Malang and Surabaya. Mm. So what did you do in Malang and Surabaya?
I am part of the CNET, and I strongly encourage you to look that up. It stands for Southeast Asian Neighborhood Network.
Mm-hmm.
It is a collective of urban studies scholars, even though we're not just urban studies anymore. We have people from anthropology, sociology, political science, but we are interested in the forms of neighborhoods, urban neighborhoods in different cities in Southeast Asia. And currently, we have our representative from all of the nation, the 10, 11 nations in Southeast Asia, except for Laos, mm-hmm. Laos maybe. And every year, you know, we travel to all of these different neighborhoods to see, and again, to encourage, you know, comparative imagination, to see what it's like, right, to study, to think about, because we are scholars, you know, our job is to theorize, is to critique, is to think about, you know, different forms of urbanism and urbanization in all of these places. And for the current phase of CNET, we had our opening workshop in Indonesia last year. So we kicked off in Surabaya, and we went to Malang. We went to Batu, in fact, to be more precise, and to see, you know, these different neighborhoods. And next year, the workshop will take place in Bangkok and Phnom Penh. And once again, you know, the scholars from all of these countries will come in. It is a fascinating group of people. Yeah.
I don't know about Surabaya because I rarely go there, but Malang tourism is pretty vibrant, I feel.
I think so.
Especially in Batu.
Yeah, exactly. And the case of Batu is very interesting because do you guys know anything about the story about how it's like considered villa esek among young people from Surabaya who would go there on weekend?
Yeah.
So the people of Batu, they wanted to break away from that stereotype, you know, that negative image, and again, they want to do something more creative or to actually correct, in a way, you know, the perception, the public perception of their neighborhood.
Interesting.
Yeah,
because we also have that same problem, I think, here, because I live in Bogor, and Bogor is like a city close to Jakarta, and close to Bogor, there's a touristy place, also like Batu. It's called Puncak. And the old stereotype is like a esek-esek hotel too. So it's interesting. Like, why is it always in the mountain or like in the hilltop?
It has to be somewhere, you know, secluded, somewhere that you will not find your, I don't know, parents or someone you
know. That's true. Yeah. That's true.
And not too far from Surabaya.
Yeah.
Do you feel that there's a good case study or a good example of revitalization or what do you call it? Reconstruction of heritage sites for a city in Southeast Asia?
There are different best practices, and I guess we could learn, you know, different lessons from different cases. For example, I think in Georgetown, Malaysia, they are a good example in terms of, you know, the academic depth, you know, that goes into the research. And in the case of Malacca, Malaysia as well, they are, you know, recognized for a more participatory approach. But then again, Malacca is easier because it has always been a historic city, you know, and like the original residents, you know, died a long time ago. So, and again, the size is so small, so they did not experience a lot of gentrification or touristification because it had always been a touristy kind of place for a long time. In Southeast Asia, unfortunately, I think the success stories have always been fragmented, and there is no one, you know, perfect example, to my knowledge, that, oh, they did everything right, because it is very difficult to get right, you know, historic preservation. In Southeast Asia, I think we have been doing historic preservation for 3 to 4 decades now, and for some reason, it has not been 100% successful. But again, not to discount their efforts. You know, there are some stories that there are some lessons that we could learn from.
So we always close every interview with this question: what is your favorite dish?
Thai dish.
Oh, that's difficult. How about my favorite Indonesian dish? I've been, you know, since returning from Malang and Surabaya, whatever, my Instagram feed is filled with ayam kicap manis or ayam kicap goreng, ayam goreng kicap, whatever.
Ayam goreng kicap.
yeah,
exactly. The sweet soy sauce chicken. I've been, you know, that is my favorite, and I always wanted to go back just because of that dish.
Yeah, you eat that with sambal?
Oh yeah, yeah. I eat spicy food. Yeah, but not what I found when I went to Indonesia is that people in Indonesia really really eat spicy. And sometimes a lot more spicy than Thai people. So I don't know why we are the one, you know, who get that reputation when it should be you guys. Yeah.
I mean, you guys are famous for sriracha, and that's
but not as spicy as whatever you have in Indonesia. Yeah.
What about Thai dish?
Yeah. Do you not have a favorite Thai food?
That's the thing. I have too many to name. I like food in general. I eat everything, and I like pad Thai, of course. I've been having this conversation with one of my friends about what distinguishes like Thai food from like the rest of Southeast Asian cuisines is the fact that we use lots and lots of lime. That is the taste. You know, we like things. We like spicy. You know, we like sweet. We like salty, but very very sour. Very 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 tangy.
Yeah.
And yeah.
That is right.
That's something that sets our foods apart. Yeah. Lots of lime. It's actually a new trend, I would say. When I was younger, you know, when I was growing up, we were not addicted to this much sour.
Oh, really? You
know, yeah. Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
What happened?
Exactly. I don't know what happened.
Yeah. Huh.
So, my mom's side of the family used to live in Karet. And so that whole area back in the day used to be a very vibrant batik community. It was a bunch of batik artisans, and even my mom's family, like my grandmother's siblings and cousins, they expanded to wool and silk and leather. So it was a very like vibrant artistic community, specifically for like textiles and fabric. I don't know what year like they started pushing out the batik artisans.
Only the batik and artisans, some or of them everyone, every artist.
Everyone, I guess. Mm-hmm. All of the different like fabric artists and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think some of them relocated to parts of Tangerang Selatan, South Tangerang, to reopen over there. But I think like once you move from such a strong community, it's not the same anymore, because it's like just like little clumps here and there. And then they started buying out those lands and building like high-rise office buildings and these like corporate skyscrapers and stuff. And like if you look at the banks and the consulting firms, they all operate out of office buildings that are built in those areas now. And when they were pushing out the batik makers, they also like made this law that made it illegal for them to like make batik, because they considered the dye and the wax from batik making as waste. Mm-hmm. And like apparently you're not supposed to like be creating waste and certain stuff. Mm-hmm. And you should have like certain permits, business permits, in order for you to create that kind of waste. And we had a conversation about this before in like one of our previous episodes, how it's funny how like independent business owners and entrepreneurs who make organic stuff, they get penalized for making that waste, even though it's like organic product. And then you have these like big ass factories making toxic waste that seep to, you know, like certain neighborhoods, but they don't get penalized because they are like a corporation and stuff. But anyway, I actually didn't know that area was such a vibrant batik and textile community. I thought those were just stories from my moms and my aunts. And when they tell stories, they can be like, hey, boy, and stuff.
Have you and your mom go there to see like where the family used to be located exactly?
No. Actually, I asked many times, but she would always say like, harus tanya like ini, harus tanya ini. You know, she would be like, gotta ask this. And also it's changed completely. So I know that because it's also like different parts, right? So there's my grandma, and then there's my grandma's siblings, and then there's my grandma's cousin. So they ended up like having their own like houses and stuff. But it was spread around like, you know, Karet, Tengsin, Karet Sudirman, Karet Kuningan, Karet Semanggi, and stuff.
You know, like whenever you talked about family, it's always attached to a certain place, right? And imagine if you're displaced, like what we were talking about with Tao.
Yeah. The women's lineage in my family, like from my grandmother, that's when people started moving, because before that they had been in Karet for like hundreds of years. And then my grandmother, when she married my grandfather, she had to move up to central Jakarta, to like Mangga Besar area. And then when my mom married my father, she had to move further up north to Kelapa Gading area. I wonder what it's like to like it's not even that far, you know, but like I wonder what it's like, because I do think the communities are different. I think the community in Karet and Mangga Besar are different, and I think the community in Mangga Besar and Kelapa Gading are different. And psychologically, that must have a certain effect.
Well, the storylines will continue with you. Now you're deciding which area of Jakarta to...
It's true, but we already... Okay, we had a dream house, quote-unquote, because it's a dream, because we don't even know how we're going to afford it.
I see, yeah.
It's just two generations away, but like now me and my brother, like if we wanted to buy... Or even my mom, like if she wanted to buy that land in that area in Karet, it's like so fucking expensive. And you're just like one generation removed. That's like how high things have skyrocketed, like the land prices have skyrocketed.